Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world on WSCA, LPFM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, August 13th, 2005. On today's show, we bring you current news of war resistors and peace activists, beginning with breaking news on the efforts of Cindy Sheehan, mother of a soldier killed in Iraq, who is now camping in Crawford, Texas, trying to meet with President Bush. We'll then hear an interview of a soldier who recently finished a one-year jail sentence for refusing to go back to Iraq to fight. In our second hour, we will bring you some more reflections on the 60th anniversaries of the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the latest episode of Between the Lines. We'll also have great music, announcements, and more, so stay tuned. We are starting off today's show with an in-depth look at one specific news story, that of Cindy Sheehan, whose son, Casey Sheehan, was killed in Iraq while serving in the U.S. military in April 2004. Cindy has been camped out in Crawford, Texas, for the past week, trying to get President Bush to meet with her. First, we bring you this interview of Cindy by investigative citizen blogger Brad Friedman from June 18, 2005. This was soon after her testimony at John Conyers' Downing Street Memos hearings. We want you to have a chance to hear her story in her own words. We'll then tell you the latest on her campaign.
Cindy Sheehan is now on the line. All right, Cindy. Cindy Sheehan, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Thank you for coming on to the Brad Show. Welcome.
Thank you.
You're down in New Orleans right now?
Right now, huh?
What are you doing down there?
They had a big jazz piece festival rally, and I was the main speaker.
Well, you did a great job speaking on... where's my notes here? Oh, they're all out of order. Oh, well. You did a great job speaking to the committee on Thursday. You're the founder... want to make sure I get this out. You're the founder of Gold Star Families for Peace, an organization comprised of people who have had loved ones killed in the invasion of Iraq. You can get more information at GSFP. That's Gold Star Families for Peace. org. Cindy Sheehan's life was radically altered on 04-04-04 when her oldest son, 24-year-old Army Specialist Casey Sheehan, was killed in action in Iraq. GSFP.org is dedicated to bringing our troops home before any other families need to qualify for membership, and they can be found on the web at GSFP.org. You've been an outspoken critic of the war, and you gave some pretty powerful testimony on Thursday, Cindy. But give us an idea, if you could. I hope you're not tired yet of telling the story. What happened to your son, Casey, in Iraq?
Well, gee, Brad, that's a really good question. We get all kinds of confusing accounts of what happened to Casey. The only thing I can tell you for sure is that he was killed on April 4th in Sadr City, Baghdad, and he was shot in the back of the head, and he came home in a flag-draped coffin. I just got another email from somebody who was supposedly with him that told me conflicting information from, you know, what I've heard. You know, every story that I get is different, and so I don't know what to believe. I don't know who to believe, and... like I said, that's the only thing I know for sure.
And this has been well over a year since this happened, and you still don't have what you feel is a straight story on this matter?
No, you know, I heard the first from one of his buddies that he died instantly on the field. Then I heard from a medic and a doctor that they tried to, he was breathing when he got to the aid station. Then I heard from the guy who just wrote me yesterday that he was alive and talking when he got on the ambulance. You know, this is just really, really hurtful, Brad. You can't imagine. You know, you think that maybe his best friend who told me he died instantly was just telling me that, so I would think that he didn't suffer. You know, then the only wound that that he had was at the back of his head, a gunshot wound. And this man that emailed me yesterday said that the bullet pierced his Kevlar flak jacket, his Kevlar body armor. Well, I was told he wasn't wearing Kevlar body armor, that he had a Vietnam-era flak jacket on. And even if he was wearing Kevlar body armor, he was shot in the head. So, you know, I don't know what games that people are toying with me or whatever. You know, I'm really out there, and all my information is out there. I get nuts from all over the country just emailing me all kinds of stuff. I don't know if maybe somebody who, you know, opposes what I'm doing is trying to demoralize me or something.
What you mean by notes from all over the country? You mean notes attacking you, or are they different?
Oh, yeah, definitely. One man wrote me this week, and he told me that he hopes the rest of my kids die. And to me, that's almost like a death threat.
Was this after the hearings?
No, it was after the article came out that quoted a speech I gave in Lexington, Kentucky, where I said that it would be my lifetime fulfillment to be the political stake in Bush's black heart. And I got a lot of hate mail for that that article. And can you imagine? What I did was I exercised my First Amendment right. I didn't threaten to hurt the president at all. It was a metaphor.
Right.
You know, it was a metaphor for bringing him down, for making him accountable, holding him accountable for what he's done to the world. And this person, because I exercised my First Amendment right, wants my three other children to die. And I wrote back to him and I said, you know what? That you are really a harsh judge. You know, I said, I wouldn't wish anybody having any of their kids die. You know, not even on George Bush. Even if there is a draft and his two daughters get sent over there, I wouldn't want anybody to go through what I'm going through. You know, and the man wrote back and he said, well, you just shouldn't be so mean to the president in times of war.
Unbelievable. In times of war,
yeah.
After you've lost a son, you shouldn't be so mean to the president. We're talking with Cindy Sheehan. We're going to be back here, hear a little bit more about her story and the testimony, the Downing Street Minutes, which are finally getting traction in the mainstream media. Hang in there with us, Cindy, through the bottom of the hour here. Really looking forward to talking to you some more. You're listening to The Brad Show on Raw Radio.
Think about our men and women who are serving this great nation, who are willing to give their life for the freedoms that we all enjoy, so that now we can come in here freely and say, freedom fries, please.
I voted for the resolution to commit the troops, and I feel that we've done about as much as we can do. You know, the reason of going in for weapons of mass destruction, that's all been proven that it was never that. I think it's primarily the neoconservatives who were advisors in key positions in both the Department of Defense.
What makes me angry, I wish somebody would apologize for the misinformation.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right.
You're listening to The Brad Show on Raw Radio. I am your friendly citizen blogger, Brad Friedman. We're speaking with Cindy Sheehan, whose son, Casey, Army Specialist, was killed in Iraq in April of 2004. You were listening there at the top of that. That was a clip from Walter Jones, Republican congressman from North Carolina, who I think really needs to be applauded here. He's the guy who changed the French fries to freedom fries in the congressional cafeteria, and well, he's singing a different tune right now. He thinks that we were lied to go into war, and I gotta commend him in this atmosphere for coming out and saying that he made a mistake and that somebody owes folks like Cindy Sheehan an apology. Especially in this atmosphere when, as Cindy was telling us before the break, she's received all kinds of hate mail and attacks and everything else for speaking out. She gave a speech where she said, Gregory, our engineer, had a comment on your speech when you had said that you hoped to drive a political stake through George Bush's black heart. And our engineer Gregory says he didn't know Bush had a heart. So,
yeah, I was giving him some credit.
People
should be happy that I, you know, acknowledge he might have a heart.
Yeah, at least you gave him a heart in your story. You were given an apology, speaking of which, by Sheila Jackson Lee on Thursday during those hearings when you gave very moving testimony. Mm-hmm. Is she the first one on behalf of the government to actually give you an apology of that sort?
Yes. Well, no. Actually, I met with Walter Jones Wednesday, and he apologized. And, you know, it means a lot coming from him because, you know, he actually voted for the war and, you know, said some very inflammatory things to get the nation all riled up for war. And Sheila Jackson Lee is like the last person that has to apologize to us. You know, she's always been a warrior for peace and justice. So, but it was nice. It was nice that she did it on behalf of everybody, you know. But really for us, apologies aren't sufficient. You know, they need to be, every Republican, every Democratic congressperson who, 40% of them won't stand up and do the right thing. They need to hold somebody accountable for this mess. And bring our troops home.
So
you know, that's what they have to struggle for right now. I don't care if they're a Democrat or a Republican.
So by holding someone accountable, you don't mean giving them a raise or a promotion or the Freedom Medal?
Yeah, a medal or something like that, right. I mean that somebody should have to face some prison time, you know, for what they did. That's what we mean, you know, not just to apologize, which is good, you know, and it's good. Walter Jones is an amazing man of courage, and that's what Congress has to do. They all have to recognize that they made a mistake and fix the mistake. You know, Walter Jones, I told him, sir, you have blood on your hands, but you're washing it off.
Yeah.
There's no way you can turn back. We can't look in the past. We have to acknowledge our mistakes and go into the future.
Yeah.
And the only way to rectify the mistakes is to bring our troops home.
Yeah, and you know, I've had, when the story came out about Walter Jones changing his tune, so to speak, I had some commenters on the blog who, you know, they were still mad. They were still angry at him for having done this in the first place. And I can understand that, but we have to be able to acknowledge our mistakes. If anything is going to change in Washington, we're going to need a bunch of people who are willing to come out and say, hey, I made a mistake. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand. And so, in truth, guys, folks following along on the open thread there at Brad Blog, you know what? We should send Walter Jones a message and saying thank you. Thank you for having the courage to admit that you made a mistake. On the Brad blog, Nanit writes, I really admire Cindy Sheehan's courage and resolve. Wherever she gets her strength, may it keep streaming so she can continue her good work. Thank you, Cindy Sheehan.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, if you want to speak with Cindy, you can try your luck. We'll see if we can get you in at 323-650-1286. Were you a supporter of the war prior to Casey going out there, or were you always against this war?
Always against this war. I've been against really war anyway in theory, but my whole family was against the war, even Casey. You know, Casey said that it was wrong. He didn't agree with how George Bush was using the military, but, you know, Casey said, he's my commander-in-chief, I have to do my duty, my pals are going over, my buddies are going over there, and I can't let them go without me, you know, so I think if he had been there longer for 5 days, I think he would have changed his position on that, but he was only in Iraq 5 days before he was killed. And I really admire the war resistors like Pablo Paredes and Kevin Benderman and Camilo Mejia, who refused to be used as tools for the war machine. They refused to kill innocent people and die for lies. And And Schools for Families for Peace support people like that, especially ones who are vocal, who don't just quietly refuse to go, but stand up and say, I'm not going, and this is why I'm not going, because this war is immoral, this war is illegal. If I go over there and kill people, I'm a war criminal. Mm. You know, and that takes a lot of courage, too. I don't feel what I have is courage or strength. I get my strength from the millions of people who are still in harm's way. You know, I get my strength from just not being able to stand one more mother collapsing on the floor screaming for her child in such an illegal and immoral war. And I think it would be more courageous for me not to do what I'm doing, because I would have to live with myself. And that's what Walter Jones said. Walter Jones says, I'm not popular in my district right now, but in the end, I'm going to have to face my maker, and I don't want this on my conscience. You know, and I don't say, you know, I don't do it to face God. I do it because I have to face myself. You know, and I hope one day to have grandchildren, and how can I look at them and say, Grandma didn't do everything she could.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't give Casey a very good world, but I can fight and try to give, you know, our children who are still here a better world.
Well, you've been doing a remarkable job of fighting. I recall the first time I saw you was on, you did an ad, and this was prior to the election, as I recall, a series called Real Voices, and yours was the first one, and I thought it was extraordinary. I linked up at bradblog.com right away, because, you know, it just, people weren't coming out. You weren't hearing yet from soldiers, from family members saying something had gone wrong. Greg, do you have 10? Let me play this real quick. Clip number 10. Go ahead, Greg.
His sergeant said, Sheehan, you don't have to go, because my son was a mechanic. He was a Humvee mechanic. And Casey said, where my chief goes, I go. And he knew what had to be done. He died in his best friend's arms in Iraq. I imagined it would have hurt if one of my kids was killed, but I never thought it would hurt this bad. Especially someone so honest and brave as Casey, my son. When you haven't been honest with us, when you and your advisors rushed us into this war, how do you think we felt when we heard the Senate report that said there was no link between Iraq and 9/11?
That was Cindy Sheehan in an advertisement that played prior to the war. I'm sorry, prior to the election. Yeah, and I thought you were pretty brave for speaking out and doing that in this incredible political atmosphere where someone like you would receive hate mail for what you're doing. You know, who gave the greatest sacrifice, well...
So we're war victims.
Yeah.
You know, Casey's a war victim, my family's a war victim, humanity is a war victim, because we continue to allow it to happen. We continue to allow the maniacs in Washington to do this in our name. And when are we as a people going to rise up and say enough is enough? You know, because we're the checks and balances. We don't have, you know, this country is unilateral right now. It's very, very vertical. There's nobody to check these people. I saw Dick Gephardt on TV the other day saying the Downing Street memo is old news. It's already been talked about, so we should move on.
Yeah.
Who talked about it?
Yeah, no, it's already, Ken Melman said it's already been discredited. Scotty McClellan says we've already discussed this, so let's move on. Well, there's been about, 8 or 9 now, I think. I got a note from managing editor John Byrne, managing editor of Raw Story, that there are new documents that have come out within the last hour, actually, from the Times of London again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, haven't gotten to see them yet, but this thing is not going away. I think the hearings were extraordinary, simply extraordinary, for those of us out here watching. What was it like? We have just about a minute before we have to go to the break, and we'll have one last segment with you. But clearly it was a supportive group down there in that 15 by 30 foot room.
Mm-hmm.
Were you given explanations by anyone on the Republicans on the U.S. House Judiciary Committee why they weren't having these hearings?
I think they Sensenbrenner just refuses to call them, you know. And
have you tried to get an audience with him?
Actually, I haven't yet, but that's my next move.
All right, we're speaking with Cindy Sheehan from Gold Star Families for Peace. GSFP.org. Thanks so much for being here with us. Cindy Sheehan from Gold Star Families for Peace, GSFP.org. Really appreciate it. Hope you will come back and talk with us again,
of course,
Cindy.
Brad. Thank you.
Thank you.
Now for an update on Cindy Sheehan's campout in Crawford, Texas, where she's trying to meet with the president about the death of her son in Iraq. This comes from the Lone Star Iconoclasts website, where they feature a Cindy Watch. You may have heard the interview on WSCA of the editor of the Iconoclast by Stanley Longstaff this past Wednesday. Here's the latest, brought to you live with Damon Thomas. You're listening to Making Waves.
Got married in a hurry and we had us a son back in 1973. I was drafted at the end of the Vietnam War, though I never did go overseas. But I remember the look on the ones who came back. Their faces still haunt me so. And I made myself a promise I would do what it takes so Jimmy didn't have to go. 'Cause if Jimmy didn't have to go, there's nothing I wouldn't do. That boy means the world to me, and he ought to mean the world to you. I don't know why we throw lives away and come home with nothing to show. I only know I would sell my soul if Jimmy didn't have to go. I went from the Army to the Army Reserves. There's nothing that moves I can't fix. I didn't think much about it, just a weekend warrior. Then I turned 36, and they called me in, and they shipped me out. I'm thinking now I could have said no, but I whispered to Kathy we would finish it early, so Jimmy didn't have to go. 'Cause if Jimmy didn't have to go, there's nothing I wouldn't do. That boy means the world to me, he ought to mean the world to you. I don't know why we throw lives away and come home with nothing to show. I only know I would sell my soul if Jimmy didn't have to go. They said it wouldn't come to hand, though the border's just a mile away. Well, the enemy surprised us from behind. They were running back the other way. Guess they were looking for a place to hide. Guess they were looking for a face they'd know. Wondering what the hell they were doing there and why they ever had to go. But if Jimmy didn't have to go, there's nothing I wouldn't do. That boy means the world to me, and he ought to mean the world to you. I don't know why we throw lives away and come home with nothing to show. I only know I would sell my soul if Jimmy didn't have to go. I killed a soldier with a silent knife. I pulled him down on top of me. I looked into the eyes, looking back into mine. He couldn't have been 17. I held him as he died so quiet. I held him as he died so slow. I held him till I knew it wasn't enough, that Jimmy didn't have to go. They sent me up for court-martial, 'cause I wouldn't do a thing I was told. Their lawyer said I was a coward, mine said I was just too old. But it wasn't the fear of the bombs above or the fear of the gas below. I'm afraid to meet the eyes of the Iraqi father whose Jimmy had to go. 'Cause if his Jimmy didn't have to go, God, there's nothing I wouldn't do. That boy means the world to me now, and he ought to mean the world to you. I don't know why we throw lives away and come home with nothing to show. I only know there's a time to say no, and Jimmy didn't have to go.
That was Charlie King and Karen Brandaugh with If Jimmy Didn't Have to Go. Now for an interview with Camilo Mejia, an 8-year Army veteran and squad leader in Iraq who decided that he could not continue fighting in good conscience. He applied for conscientious objector status but was denied. He was jailed for desertion by the U.S. military for 1 year, getting out this past spring. This interview is by Lisa Moore for Red Eye Radio.
Camilo Mejia was an 8-year veteran of the U.S. Army, a staff sergeant, and a squad leader. In October 2003, he returned home on leave from fighting in Iraq. He never returned. After he turned himself in, the Army rejected Mejia's application for conscientious objector status. In May 2004, a court-martial sentenced him to a year in jail on a charge of desertion. He was released in February. Since then, he has been speaking out against the war and trying to put his life back together. We've reached Camilo Mejia at his home in Miami. Good morning, Camilo.
Good morning, Lisa.
So when you came home from Iraq in late 2003, why did you decide not to return to finish your tour of duty?
Well, I must say that from the very beginning of the war, I had political opposition against it. I had been perhaps not too involved personally, because I was reading the news like everybody else and thinking how the war didn't really make sense politically in terms of weapons of mass destruction and stockpiles of chemical weapons. But I still went because, in part because I was afraid to oppose the war publicly. I was afraid of being tried by a court-martial. So I deployed hoping that it would be perhaps even just a show of force. There was incredible opposition against the war. But once we got there, you know, as everybody knows, the war started, and then we started getting involved in more direct combat missions, and we started seeing how, you know, innocent people really paid the price of war. Our first mission in Iraq for my unit was to run a POW camp, prisoner of war camp, and one of the things that we had to do was to keep prisoners awake for periods of 48 to 72 hours. And we did this by banging sledgehammers against walls next to the prisoners who were hooded and tied. And then, you know, if that didn't work, you know, we would perform mock executions, you know, to make them think that, you know, that we were about to shoot them in the head. You know, we did this with pistols, or we were told to do this with pistols. And this is the first mission that we have there. And, you know, it begins to transform, the opposition begins to transform from political and impersonal to more personal, moral, involved opposition against the war, because not, you know, no longer am I reading about these things, no longer am I just watching this on the news, but I'm the one actually doing these things, the one, you know, performing the abuse, the one occupying, the one killing civilians. And I mean, it's just, there's so many things, you know, why one should oppose war. You also have, for instance, you know, things that have nothing to do with the politics of it, things that have nothing to do with whether, if you agree with war, things that have nothing to do with whether the war is justified or unjustified. For instance, you know, the ambition of officers who want to get promoted and, you know, want to get the medals and the awards, you know, and how they do things deliberately to instigate firefights, you know, against every training that we've received as infantrymen by means of, you know, making ourselves predictable, you know, giving away the element of surprise, doing the same missions over and over. You know, just a number of things that we did that we weren't supposed to do just so that we would instigate firefights. In the process of doing this, you know, soldiers lose their lives. You know, they lose limbs. You know, they become traumatized. Civilians get killed, you know, who had absolutely nothing to do with the war. But at the same time, it's really difficult, you know, to come up with political or moral or philosophical analysis of the war because you're being shot at every day. You know, you're being bombed every day. There's a bomb. There could be a bomb in every corner, you know, every curve. You know, there's no such thing as a front line in Iraq. You know, the war is being fought everywhere, you know, from mosques, schools, hospitals, roads. You get bombed, you know, you get mortared, you know, where you live. So it's really hard to really sit down and analyze the war and say, okay, I don't want to participate. You know, you just want to get out of there alive. But once I come home, you know, I have more clarity of mind. I have more, hold on a second. You have more, I guess more peace, you know, to make decisions, you know, to actually sit down and hold on a second. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry, my 5-year-old daughter is here with me.
That's okay.
So, you know, you start asking for, you start searching for purpose, you know, you start searching for justifications, you know, you start asking yourself, is it worth it, you know, doing all these things, you know, killing all these people, exposing ourselves so officers can get promoted. And, you know, you start trying to find reasons, and all you find is, you know, just a bunch of lies. And, you know, it's really difficult, or at least it was for me, you know, to say, okay, there's no reason why we should be fighting this war. You know, all these innocent people are dying, but, you know, I'm still going to go back. I couldn't, you know, I couldn't in good conscience say, okay, I'm going to participate in this war simply because I signed a military contract, and it's my duty as a soldier. It's not my duty as a soldier. And even if it were, you know, before being a soldier, I was a human being, you know, with principles and morals and a conscience. So, you know, I made the painful decision, and I have to say it was a painful decision, not to return. And it was painful because it meant, you know, not going back to my squad and the people in my unit, who I really care about, and also because of the possibility of, you know, going to jail and, you know, God knows for how long, and being away from my family, which in the end did happen. But I can't say that it's a decision that I regretted. You know, I mean, I feel much better now. I feel much stronger as a human being, you know, because I actually did what I believed. And, you know, I'm active, you know, in my opposition against the war. You know, I'm an anti-war activist. You know, I'm a member of Iraq Veterans Against the War. And, you know, I continue to oppose the war and to do my political activism until the war is over, and, you know, even beyond that.
You've written about how some people call you a hero while others call you a coward for what you did. You say you're somewhere in the middle. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, you know, I don't think, first of all, I don't believe in heroes. I really don't. I think, you know, ordinary people are put in extraordinary situations where, you know, they can do extraordinary things, you know, but I don't think that necessarily makes them heroes. You know, what actually makes, if you're a religious person, miracles happen is, you know, the unity of ordinary people, you know, doing extraordinary things, you know, coming together, you know, organizing an anti-war rally, you know, voting off a president, a group of soldiers, you know, putting down their weapons and saying, we're not going to fight this. You know, those are all small things that once you put them together, you know, they bring about, you know, tremendous change. Heroes by themselves, you know, if you do believe in the concept of hero, don't really make this type of things happen, you know. And the people who did call me a coward, you know, they in a way they were right, you know, because I went to the war in part because I was afraid. Because I was afraid of being tried, I was afraid of precisely being called a coward, because I was afraid of, you know, spending time in jail. And out of fear, I went to a war that I opposed. But they're wrong because most of the people who call me a coward, you know, call me a coward because they think that I did not return to the war for out of fear of being killed. And I have to say that there was that fear of being killed, but there are worse fears in war. You know, there's fear of, you know, killing innocent people. There's fear of losing your soul in the process of, you know, saving your own body, you know, making it home alive. And I believe that the fear that was at play, you know, in my whole participation in war, I guess like the strongest fear, the one fear that one should look at is the fear that led me to participate in the war. You know, not participating, not further participating in the war, was a greater fear than actually going back to combat. You know, because it's a very dreadful thing to tell the military, look, this war is oil driven, I'm not a mercenary, I'm not going to fight your war, I'm a conscientious objector. A lot of people feel the same way, but, you know, they'd rather take their chances in combat than to actually make a stand for themselves. So it's not, I wouldn't call that cowardice at all.
You went into hiding for a period of time after you went away without leave, but then you decided to turn yourself into the authorities. What motivated you to do that?
Well, when I first came back, actually, there have been plenty of irregularities about the way that I have been extended and deployed. First of all, my contract had ended by the time I allegedly went AWOL. I am not a citizen of the United States. I am a citizen of both Costa Rica and Nicaragua. And there's an international treaty between Costa Rica and the United States where, you know, citizens of, you know, either country cannot be forced into military participation, you know. So basically, you know, the United States cannot involuntarily extend my contract, yet they did. They also violated an army regulation saying that, you know, non-citizens can't stay in the military more than 8 years unless they've applied for citizenship. And a number of other irregularities that I pointed out to the military command when I came back, and they pretty much agreed with me. They said, yeah, you're right, you know, you should not have been deployed, you should not have been extended, you should have never left Florida, which is my state. Yet they all told me, but your leave is expiring and you have to go back because your leave is expiring. You know, so it didn't really make a whole lot of sense. It was like, it was this unwillingness, you know, to uphold their own laws and regulations. And I didn't really feel that I could be tried fairly, you know, by, you know, the military legal bureaucracy. So I went and sought civilian counsel. I applied for conscientious objection. I put together a case, you know, we had witnesses, we had several arguments. But the intention was never to, you know, separate myself from the military. The intention was always to not go back to the war, but that's a separate thing from allegedly going AWOL, you know. I did not go back to the military because I did not think that the military would uphold its own law, so I went out and sought civilian counsel. But they're separate things. The objective was never to separate myself from the military. I had a legitimate claim for being discharged, and you know, my intention was always to, you know, fight that claim in court, and that's what I ended up doing.
You were then court-martialed and convicted on charges of desertion and missing a movement. I understand that the court refused to hear evidence about the violations of international law and army procedure you witnessed in Iraq. What happened at the trial?
Well, we had, as part of my defense team, we had former Attorney General of the United States, Ramsey Clark, who testified to the applicability of the Costa Rica-United States Treaty to my case. The judge heard him and decided not to allow the argument to be brought before the panel. We also had an expert in international law, Professor Francis Boyle, who testified that, you know, the war had been illegal because, number one, you know, the war can only be illegal on two counts. One is the in self-defense, and two is, you know, with the approval of the UN Security Council. which we had none. We had neither, you know, before going to this war. We still don't. And also because of the many violations that are happening in Iraq, you know, like, for instance, you know, things that I witnessed and participated in, you know, the POW camp, you know, sleep deprivation and all these things that are happening right now, the abuse of prisoners is completely illegal in international law. The judge heard that but did not want to allow it into the arguments to be brought up, you know, before the panel, which is a jury. Key witnesses, you know, that we had that would have testified to the illegality of my deployment, you know, witnesses from the military also were not allowed to testify. Basically, the judge and the prosecution, what they, the only thing that they allowed was, you know, evidence as to whether I got on the plane or not. You know, they brought it down to the issue of whether this soldier got on the plane when he was supposed to get on the plane, you know, to, you know, go back to his unit in accordance with his leave. And they did not want to listen to anything dealing with the illegality of the war or what troops are doing in Iraq to Iraqis. They just did not allow the war to be put on trial. We did put it on trial anyway because we have several reporters who wrote about it, but more in a public way, you know, not so much a legal way. And then this year in May, I attended a court martial, the court martial of sailor Pablo Paredes in San Diego, and it was the same thing. You know, they brought in an expert in international law, Professor Marjorie Kahn, who also put the war on trial. The military judge did not want to listen to it. He did say that, you know, every serviceman and woman, you know, has, you know, a reasonable claim for saying that the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, and even Kosovo and Yugoslavia were all illegal, but he said that more as a joke, you know. But they really did not ever allow the war to be put on trial. They never look at international law. They never look at what we're doing in Iraq. It's always, you know, a matter of, you know, whether he or she went back to the war when he or she was told to. Right now we have another court-martial going on July 28th of Sergeant Kevin Benderman, who's a conscientious objector, and decided not to go back to the war, you know, because of what he saw and because of the violations that he saw and the destruction of the country that he saw and because the war is illegal. And same thing, you know, they're charging him with desertion, mismovement by design. They even added a charge of larceny. So it seems as though the military is still unwilling, you know, to look at, you know, our own violations of the law, our own violations, you know, in terms of, you know, going to war. You know, they're just bringing it down to, like, the individual case, you know, whether the soldier did or did not get on a plane or get on a ship.
Well, thank you very much, Camilo, for joining us this morning.
Okay, if I could say one more thing. For people who are interested in supporting Sergeant Kevin Benderman, they can go to his website, which is bendermandefense.org. And there are several ways that they can help him. You know, just go to the website and maybe they can donate money or, you know, write letters or do some other thing, you know. But just please do help, you know. Military resistance is really important, you know. It's a key element in the ending the war of Vietnam. And I think that war resistance should be supported, you know, every step of the way. So bendermandefense.org.
Great. Thank you very much, Camilo. Camilo Mejia is a former U.S. soldier who is with Iraq Veterans Against the War. He was on the line with us from Miami.
The new ruling party is holding the aces. The rest of the cards are all missing faces. I'm sorry I can't know you today. What can one say? I will not obey. Give us your sons and give us your daughters. No one is safe or immune from the slaughter. How indifference makes them rage. What can one say? I will not obey. National Guard or freedom fighters, all houses belong to cigarette lighters. But who hides in the smoke? What can one say? I will not obey. Better perhaps to perish outside of the bunkers where our generals hide. I turn away and spit. What can one say? I will not obey. Give us the minds of your children to learn the substance of books we have not yet burned. But can they read the sky for rain? What can one say? I will not obey. Soon all tyrants will feel our impatience. We choose to create our own combinations. I was always willing to agree. What can one say? I will not obey. The essence of contract is agreement, not coercion or obedience. And agreement is sacred. What can one say? I will not obey. There are so few wars of people's liberation, for the people have so seldom risen. Only the armed faction, listen, the armed faction lies. They recreate the state through their action. When the people rise, it is not they, but the state which dies. I sing this song for the prisoners' release, most of all now for the new state police. You see, the guns have changed hands. Again, what can one say? I will not obey.
We just heard Utah Phillips with I Will Not Obey. Previous to that was the interview with Camilo Mejia, war resister. To hear previous Making Waves shows, please visit our archive online. You can find that at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show, or let us know that you need that long web address spelled out for you, or let us know that you want to work with us and help create this show. Also, feel free to call the station in the next hour for more info. The number here is 430-9722. That's 430-WSCA.